3. So, Jeanette, what's going on?
Jeanette considered Clint's opening gambit.
Let's see. Ree said she had a dream last night about eating cake with Michelle Obama. The two of them, prison psychiatrist and patient inmate, were making slow circuits of the exercise yard. It was deserted at this time of the morning, when most of the inmates were busy at their various jobs, carpentry, furniture manufacturer, maintenance, laundry, cleaning, or attending GED classes in what was known in Dueling Correctional as dumb school, or simply lying in their cells and stacking time. Pinned to the top of Jeanette's beige smock top was a yard pass signed by Clint himself, which made him responsible for her. That was okay. She was one of his favorite patient inmates, one of his pets, Warden Janice Coates would have said, annoyingly, and the least troublesome. In his opinion, Jeanette belonged on the outside, not in another institution, but outside altogether, walking free. It wasn't an opinion he would have offered to Jeanette, because what good would that do her? This was Appalachia. In Appalachia, you didn't get a free pass on murder. It didn't matter if it was second degree. His belief in Jeanette's lack of culpability in the death of Damien Sorley was the sort of thing that he wouldn't express to anyone except his wife, and maybe not even to her. Lately, Lila seemed a little off, a little preoccupied. This morning, for instance, although that was probably because she needed some sleep. And there was that thing Vanessa Lampley had said about an overturned pet food truck on Mountain Rest Road last year. How likely was it that there had been two identical bizarre accidents months apart? Hey, Dr. Ann, are you there? I said that Ree had a dream about eating with Michelle Obama. Got it. That's what she said at first, but she just made that up. She actually had a dream about a teacher telling her she was in the wrong classroom. Total anxiety dream, wouldn't you say? Could be. It was one of about a dozen default positions he kept ready for answering patient questions. Hey, Doc, you think Tom Brady might come here? Give a speech, sign some autographs? Could be. You know, he could sign some of those little toy footballs.
Sure.
Jeanette stopped.
What did I just say?
Clint thought about it, then laughed. Busted.
Where are you this morning, Doc? You're doing that thing you do. Pardon me for, like, barging in on your personal space, but is everything okay at home?
With a nasty internal start, Clint realized he was no longer sure that was true. And Jeanette's unexpected question, her insight, was unsettling. Lila had lied to him. There hadn't been a crash on the Mountain Rest Road. Not last night. He was suddenly sure of that.
Everything's fine at home. What's the thing I do?
She made a frowny face and held up her fist and ran her thumb back and forth over her knuckles.
When you do that, I know you're out there picking daisies or something. It's almost like you're remembering a fight you were in.
Ah, said Clint. That was too close for comfort. Old habit.
Let's talk about you, Jeanette.
My favorite subject.
It sounded good, but Clint knew better. If he let Jeanette lead the conversation, they would spend this entire hour in the sun talking about Ree Dempster, Michelle Obama, Tom Brady, and whomever else she could free associate. When it came to free association, Jeanette was a champ.
Okay, what did you dream about last night? If we're going to talk about dreams, let's talk about yours, not Ree's.
I can't remember. Ree asked me, and I told her the same thing. I think it's that new med you put me on.
So you did dream something?
Yeah, probably. Jeanette was looking at the vegetable garden rather than at him.
Could it have been about Damien? You used to dream about him quite a bit.
Sure, about how he looked, all blue. But I haven't had the blue man dream in a long time.
Hey, do you remember that movie, The Omen, about the son of the devil? That kid's name was Damien, too.
You have a son.
So?
She was looking at him now, and a bit distrustfully.
Well, some people might say your husband was the devil in your life, which would make Bobby the son of the devil. Omen, too.
She pealed laughter, pointing a finger at him.
Oh, that's too funny. Bobby is the sweetest kid in the world, takes after my mama's side of the family. He comes all the way from Ohio with my sister to see me every other month, you know that.
She laughed some more, a sound not common to this fenced and strictly monitored acre of ground, but very sweet.
You know what I'm thinking.
Nope, Clint said. I'm a shrink, not a mind reader.
I'm thinking this might be a classic case of transference.
She wiggled the first two fingers of each hand in the air to make quotation marks around the key word.
As in, you're worried that your boy is the devil's child.
It was Clint's turn to laugh. The idea of Jared as the devil's anything, Jared, who brushed mosquitoes off his arms rather than swatting them, was surreal. He worried about his son, yes, but not that he would ever wind up behind bars and barbed wire like Jeanette and Ree Dempster and Kitty McDavid and the ticking time bomb known as Angel Fitzroy. Hell, the kid didn't even have enough nerve to ask Mary Pack to go to the spring dance with him. Jared's fine, and I'm sure your Bobby is too. How's that medication doing with your, what do you call them?
My blurries. That's when I can't see people just right or hear them just right. It's all kinds of better since I started the new pills.
You're not just saying that because you have to be honest with me, Jeanette. You know what I always say,
HPD, honesty pays dividends.
And I'm being straight with you. It's better.
I sometimes still get down, though. Then I start to drift and the blurries come back.
Any exceptions? Anyone who comes through loud and clear even when you're depressed and can maybe bootstrap you out of it?
Bootstrap. I like that.
Yeah, Bobby can. He was 5 when I came in here, 12 now. He plays keyboards in a group, can you believe that? And sings.
You must be very proud.
I am. Yours must be about the same age, right? Clint, who knew when one of his ladies was trying to turn the conversation, made a noncommittal noise instead of telling her that Jared was approaching voting age, weird as that seemed to him. She thumped his shoulder.
Make sure he's got condoms.
From the umbrella-shaded guard post near the north wall, an amplified voice blared,
Prisoner, no physical contact!
Clint tossed the officer a wave, hard to tell because of the loud hailer, but he thought the uni in the lawn chair was that asshole Don Peters, to show all was cool and then said to Jeanette, Now I'm gonna have to discuss this with my therapist. She laughed, pleased. It occurred to Clint, not for the first time, that if circumstances were entirely different, he would have wanted Jeanette sorely for a friend. Hey, Jeanette, you know who Warner Wolf is?
Let's go to the videotape,
she responded promptly, a spot-on imitation.
Why do you ask?
It was a good question. Why did he ask? What did an old sportscaster have to do with anything? And why should it matter if his pop culture frame of reference, like his physique, was a little out of date? Another better question. Why had Lila lied to him? Oh, Clint said. Someone mentioned him. Struck me funny.
Yeah, my dad loved him, Jeanette said.
Your dad. A snatch of Hey Jude came from his phone. He looked at the screen and saw his wife's picture. Lila, who should have been deep in dreamland. Lila, who might or might not remember Warner Wolf. Lila, who had lied. I need to take this, he told Jeanette, but I'll keep it brief. You should stroll over there to the garden, pull some weeds, and see if you can remember what you dreamed last night. Little privacy. Got it, she said and walked toward the garden. Clint waved toward the north wall again, indicating to the officer that Jeanette's move was sanctioned, then pushed accept. Hey, Lila, what's going on? Aware, as it came out of his mouth, that it was how he had started many a patient conference. Oh, the usual, she said. Meth lab explosion, double homicide, doer in custody. I collared her strolling up Balls Hill pretty much in her altogether. This is a joke, right? Afraid not. Holy shit, are you okay? Running on pure adrenaline, but otherwise fine. I need some help, though. She filled in the details. Clint listened, not asking questions. Jeanette was working herself along a row of peas, pulling weeds and singing something cheerful about going uptown to the Harlem River to drown. At the north end of the prison yard, Vanessa Lampley approached Don Peters' lawn chair, spoke to him, then took the seat as Don trudged toward the admin wing, head down like a kid who's been called to the principal's office. And if anyone deserved to be called in, it was that bag of guts and waters. Clint, are you still there?
Right here, just thinking.
Just thinking, Lila repeated. About what? about the process. The way she pressed him took Clint aback. It almost seemed like she had been mocking him. In theory, it's possible, but I'd have to check with Janice.
Then do it, please. I can be there in 20 minutes. And if Janice needs convincing, convince her. I need help here, Clint.
Calm down. I'll do it. Fear of self-harm is a valid concern. Jeanette had finished one row and was working her way back toward him along the next. I'm just saying that ordinarily you'd take her to St. Terry's first to get her checked out. Sounds like she whammed her face pretty good.
Her face isn't my immediate concern. She nearly tore one man's head off and stuck another guy's head through a trailer wall. Do you really think I should put her in an exam room with some 25-year-old resident?
He wanted to ask again if she was all right, but in her current mood she'd go ballistic. Because when you were tired and ragged, that's what you did, lashed out at the person who was safe. Sometimes, often even, Clint resented having to be the safe one. Perhaps not. Now he could hear street sounds. Lila had left the building.
It's not just that she's dangerous, and it's not just that she's off her gourd. It's like, Jared would say, my spidey sense is tingling.
Maybe when he was 7.
I've never seen her before in my life. I'd swear to that on a pile of Bibles, but she knows me. She called me by name.
If you're wearing your uniform shirt, and I assume you are, there's a name tag on your breast pocket.
Right, but all it says is Norcross. She called me Lila. I have to get off the phone. Just tell me that when I get there with her, the welcome mat will be out.
It will be.
Thank you.
He heard her clear her throat.
Thank you, honey.
You're welcome, but you have to do something for me. Don't bring her alone. You're beat.
Reed Barrows will be driving. I'm riding shotgun.
Good. Love you. There was the sound of a car door opening, probably Lila's cruiser.
Love you too,
she said, and clicked off. Was there a slight hesitation there? No time to think about that now, to pick at it until it turned into something it probably wasn't, which was just as well.
Jeanette!
And when she turned to him,
I'm going to have to cut our session short. Something has come up.
4. Bullshit was Coates's archenemy. Not that most people were friends with it or even liked it, but they put up with bullshit, came to an understanding with it, and they dished up their fair share. Warden Janice Tabitha Coates didn't bullshit. It wasn't in her disposition, and it would have been counterproductive anyway. Prison was basically a bullshit factory. Call it the dueling bullshit manufacturing facility for women. And it was her job to keep production from raging out of control. Waves of bullshit memos came down from the state that demanded she simultaneously cut costs and improve services. A steady stream of bullshit flowed from the courts, inmates and defense attorneys and prosecutors bickering over appeals, and Coates always seemed to get drawn in somehow. The health department loved to drop in for bullshit inspections. The engineers who came to repair the prison electrical grid always promised that this would be the last time, but their promises were bullshit. The grid kept right on crashing. And the bullshit didn't stop while Coates was at home. Even as she slept, it piled up, like a drift in a snowstorm, a brown drift made of bullshit. Like Kitty McDavid going nuts, and the two physician's assistants picking the same exact morning to go AWOL. That stinking pile had been waiting for her the moment she stepped through the door. Norcross was a solid shrink, but he produced his share of bovine excrement, too, requesting special treatments and dispensations for his patients. His chronic failure to recognize that the vast majority of his patients, the inmates of dueling, were themselves bullshit geniuses, women who had spent their lives nurturing bullshit excuses, was almost touching, except that it was Coates who had to wield the shovel. And hey, underneath their bullshit, some of the women did have real reasons. Janice Coates wasn't stupid, and she wasn't heartless. Lots of the women of dueling were, above all else, luckless. Coates knew that. Bad childhoods, horrible husbands, impossible situations. Mental illnesses medicated with drugs and alcohol. They were victims of bullshit as well as purveyors of it. However, it wasn't the warden's job to sort any of that out. Pity could not be allowed to compromise her duty. They were here, and she had to take care of them. Which meant she had to deal with Don Peters, who appeared before her now, the bullshit artist supreme, just finishing his latest bullshit story,
The honest working man, unfairly accused. When he had put on the finishing touches, she said, "Don't give me that union crap, Peters. One more complaint and you're out. I got one inmate saying you grabbed her breast, I've got another saying you squeezed her butt, and I've got a third saying you offered her half a pack of Newports to suck you off. The union wants to go to the mattresses for you, that's their choice, but I don't think they will." The squat little officer sat on her couch with his legs spread wide, as if his basket was something she wanted to look at, and his arms crossed. He blew at the Buster Brown bangs that hung down over his eyebrows. "I never touched anyone, Warden." "No shame in resigning." "I'm not quitting, and I'm not ashamed of anything I've done." Red suffused his normally pale cheeks. "Must be nice. I've got a list of things I'm ashamed of. Signing off on your application in the first place is near the top of it. You're like a booger I can't get off my finger." Don's lips took on a crafty twist. "I know you're trying to make me angry, Warden. It won't work." He wasn't stupid, was the thing. That was the reason no one had nailed him so far. Peters was canny enough to make his moves when no one else was around. Guess not. Coates, seated on the edge of her desk, pulled her bag into her lap. "Can't blame a girl for trying." "You know they lie. They're criminals." "Sexual harassment's a crime, too. You've had your last warning." Coates rummaged in her bag, searching for a chapstick. "By the way, only half a pack? Come on, Dawn." She yanked out tissues, her lighter, her pill bottle, her iPhone, wallet, and finally found what she was looking for. The cap had fallen off, and the stick was flecked with bits of lint. Janice used it anyway. Peters had fallen silent. She looked at him. He was a punk and an abuser, and incredibly fortunate that another officer hadn't stepped forward as a witness to any of the abuses. She'd get him, though. She had time. Time was, in fact, another word for prison. "What, you want some?" Coates held out her chapstick. "No, then get back to work." The door rattled in the frame when he slammed it, and she heard him thudding flat-footed out of the reception area like a teen doing a tantrum. Satisfied that the disciplinary session had gone about as she had expected, Coates returned to the matter of her linty chapstick and began to stir around in her bag for the cap. Her phone vibrated. Coates set her bag on the floor and walked to the vacated couch. She considered how much she disliked the person whose ass had last been planted there and sat down to the left of the dent in the center cushion. "Hi, Mom." Behind Michaela's voice was the sound of other voices, some shouting and sirens. Coates put aside her initial impulse to skin her daughter for not calling in 3 weeks. "What's wrong, honey?" "Hold on." The sounds became muffled, and Janice waited. Her relationship with her daughter had had its ups and downs. Michaela's decision to quit law school and go into television journalism, as big a bullshit factory in its own way as the prison system, and probably just as full of criminals, had been a valley, and the nose job that followed had taken them way, way below sea level for a while. There was a persistence to Michaela, however, which Coates had gradually come to respect. Maybe they weren't as different as it seemed. Daffy Magda Dubcheck, the local woman who had babysat for Janice when Michaela was a toddler, once said, "She's like you, Janice. She cannot be denied. Tell her one cookie, she make it her personal mission to eat three. Smile and giggle and sweet you up until you cannot say no." 2 years ago, Michaela had been doing puff pieces on the local news. Now she was on News America, where her rise had been rapid. "Okay," Michaela said, coming back on. "Had to get someplace quiet. They've got us outside the CDC. I can't talk long. Have you been watching the news?"
"CNN, of course." Janice loved this jab and never missed a chance to use it.
This time, Michaela ignored it. "You know about the Aurora flu, the sleeping sickness?"
"Something on the radio. Old women who can't wake up in Hawaii and Australia."
"It's real, Mom, and it's any woman. Elderly, infant, young, middle-aged, any woman who sleeps. So don't go to sleep."
"Pardon?"
Something wasn't tracking here. It was 11 in the morning. Why would she go to sleep? Was Michaela saying she should never sleep again? If so, wasn't going to work out. Might as well ask her to never pee again. That doesn't make any sense. "Turn on the news, Mom. or the radio, or the internet. The impossibility lingered between them on the line. Janice didn't know what else to say, except,
okay.
Her kid might be wrong, but her kid wouldn't lie to her. Bullshit or not, Michaela believed it was the truth. The scientist I just talked to, she's with the feds, and a friend, I trust her, is on the inside. She says that they're estimating that 85% of women in the Pacific Standard Time Zone are already out. Don't tell anyone that. It's going to be pandemonium as soon as it hits the internet.
What do you mean, out?
I mean they aren't waking up. They're forming these, they're like cocoons. Membranes, coatings. The cocoons seem to be partly cerumen, earwax, partly sebum, which is the oily stuff on the sides of your nose, partially mucus, and something else no one understands, some kind of strange protein. It reforms almost as quick as it comes off, but don't try to take it off. There have been reactions, okay? Do not attempt to remove the stuff. On this last matter, which made no more sense than the rest, Michaela seemed uncharacteristically severe. Mom? Yes, Michaela, I'm still right here. Her daughter sounded excited now, keen. It started happening between 7 and 8 our time, between 4 and 5 Pacific Standard, which is why the women west of us got hit so hard. So we've got all day. We've got just about a full tank.
A full tank of waking hours?
Bingo. Michaela heaved a breath. I know how crazy this thing sounds, but I am in no way kidding. You've got to keep yourself awake. And you're going to have some hard decisions to make. You need to figure out what you're going to do with your prison.
With my prison?
Your inmates are going to start falling asleep.
Oh, Janice said.
She suddenly did see. At least, sort of. Have to go, Mom. I've got to stand up and the producer's going crazy. I'll call when I can.
Coates stayed on the couch. Her gaze found the framed photograph on her desk. It showed the late Archibald Coates, grinning in surgical scrubs, holding his infant daughter in the crook of his arm. Dead of a coronary at the impossibly unfair age of 30, Archie had been gone now almost as long as he had lived. In the picture, there was a bit of whitish afterbirth on Michaela's forehead, like a scrap of web. The warden wished she'd told her daughter that she loved her, but the regret only held her still for a few seconds. There was work to be done. It had taken a few seconds to get a hold on the problem, but the answer, what to do with the women of the prison, did not seem to Janice to be multiple choice. For as long as she could, she needed to keep on doing what she had always done, maintain order and keep ahead of the bullshit. She told her secretary, Blanche McIntyre, to buzz their PAs again at their homes. After that, Blanche was to call Lawrence Hicks, the vice warden, and inform him that his recovery time from wisdom tooth surgery was being curtailed. He was required on the premises immediately. Finally, she needed Blanche to notify each of the officers on duty in turn. Due to the national situation, everyone was pulling a double. The warden had serious concerns about whether or not she could count on the next rotation coming in. In an emergency, people were reluctant to leave their loved ones.
What? Blanche asked. The national situation? Did something happen to the president? And you want everyone for a double? They aren't going to like that.
I don't care what they like. Turn on the news, Blanche.
I don't understand. What's happening?
If my daughter's right, you'll know it when you hear it.
Next, Coates went to get Norcross in his office. They were going to check on Kitty McDavid together. 5. Jared Norcross and Mary Pack were sitting on the bleachers during period 3 PE, their tennis rackets put aside for the time being. They and a bunch of silly sophomores on the lower tiers were watching two seniors playing on the center court, grunting like Monica Seles with each hit. The skinny one was Kurt McLeod, the muscular redhead was Eric Blass. My nemesis, Jared thought.
I don't think it's a good idea, he said.
Mary looked at him, eyebrows raised. She was tall and, in Jared's opinion, perfectly proportioned. Her hair was black, her eyes were gray, her legs long and tanned, her low tops immaculately white. Immaculate was, in fact, the best word for her, in Jared's opinion.
And that would be apropos what?
As if you don't know, Jared thought.
apropos you going to see Arcade Fire with Eric. She appeared to think this over.
Lucky you're not the one going with him, then.
Hey, remember the field trip to the Kruger Street Toy and Train Museum back in fifth grade? Mary smiled and brushed her hand, the nails painted a velvety blue through her long hair.
How could I forget? We almost didn't get in because Billy Mears wrote some nasty ink on his arm. Mrs. Colby made him stay on the bus with the driver, the one who had the stutter.
Eric lofted the ball, went up on his toes, and whacked a killer serve that barely topped the net. Instead of trying to return it, Kurt flinched back. Eric raised his arms like Rocky at the top of the Philadelphia Museum of Art steps. Mary clapped. Eric turned toward her and bowed. Jared said, "It was Mrs. Colby eats the big one on his arm, and Billy didn't put it there. Eric did. Billy was fast asleep when he did it and kept his mouth shut because staying on the bus was better than getting beaten up by Eric at a later date."
"So?"
"So Eric's a bully."
"Was a bully," Mary said. "Fifth grade was a long time ago."
"As the twig is bent, so the bough is shaped." Jared heard the pedantic tone his father sometimes adopted and would have taken it back if he could. Mary's gray eyes were on him, appraising.
"Meaning what?"
"Stop," Jared told himself. "Just shrug and say whatever and let it go." He often gave himself such good advice, and his mouth usually overrode him. It did so now. "Meaning people don't change."
"Sometimes they do. My dad used to drink too much, but he stopped. He goes to AA meetings now."
"Okay, some people do. I'm glad your father was one of them."
"You better be."
The gray eyes were still fixed on him. "But most people don't. Just think about it. The fifth grade jocks, like Eric, are still the jocks. You were a smart kid then, and you're a smart kid now. The kids who got in trouble in fifth are still getting in trouble in 11th and 12th. You ever see Eric and Billy together? No? Case closed." This time, Kurt managed to handle Eric's serve, but the return was a bunny, and Eric was vulturing the net, almost hanging over it. His return, a clear net foul, hit Kurt in the belt buckle.
"Quit it, dude!" Kurt shouted. "I might want to have kids someday!"
"Bad idea," Eric said. "Now go get that, it's my lucky ball. Fetch, Rover!" While Kurt shuffled sulkily to the chain-link fence where the ball had come to rest, Eric turned to Mary and took another bow. She gave him a 100-watt smile. It stayed on when she turned back to Jared, but the wattage dimmed considerably.
"I love you for wanting to protect me, Jer, but I'm a big girl. It's a concert, not a lifelong commitment."
Just what? The smile was all gone now. "Just watch out for him," Jared wanted to say, because writing on Billy's arm was a minor thing, a grade school thing. In high school, there have been ugly locker room stunts I don't want to talk about, in part because I never put a stop to any of them. I just watched. More good advice, and before his traitor mouth could disregard it, Mary swiveled in her seat, looking toward the school. Some movement must have caught her eye, and now Jared saw it too. A brown cloud lifting off from the gymnasium roof. It was large enough to scare up the crows that had been roosting in the oaks surrounding the faculty parking lot. Dust, Jared thought. But instead of dissipating, the cloud banked sharply and headed north. It was flocking behavior, but those weren't birds. They were too small even for sparrows.
"An eclipse of moths," Mary exclaimed. "Wow, who knew?"
"That's what you call a whole bunch of them? An eclipse?"
"Yes, who knew they flocked? And most moths leave daytime to the butterflies. Moths are fly-by nights, at least usually."
"How do you know all that?"
"I did my 8th grade science project on moths. Mot, in Old English, meaning maggot. My dad talked me into doing it because I used to be scared of them. Someone told me when I was little that if you got the dust from a moth's wings in your eyes, you'd go blind. My dad said that was just an old wives' tale, and if I did my science project on moths, I might be able to make friends with them. He said that butterflies are the beauty queens of the insect world. They always get to go to the ball. And the poor moths are the ones who get left behind like Cinderella."
He was still drinking then, but it was a fun story just the same. Those gray eyes on him, daring him to disagree.
Sure, cool, Jared said.
Did you?
Did I what?
Make friends with them.
Not exactly, but I found out lots of interesting stuff. Butterflies close their wings over their backs when they're at rest. Moths use theirs to protect their bellies. Moths have frenulums. Those are wing coupling devices, but butterflies don't. Butterflies make a chrysalis, which is hard. Moths make cocoons, which are soft and silky.
Yo!
It was Kent Daly, riding his bike across the softball field from the tangle of waste ground beyond. He was wearing a backpack and his tennis racket was slung over his shoulder.
Norcross, pack, you see all those birds take off?
They were moths, Jared said.
The ones with frenulums. Or maybe it's frenula.
Huh?
Never mind. What are you doing? It's a school day, you know. Had to take out the garbage for my ma.
Must have been a lot of it, Mary said. It's already period 3.
Kent smirked at her, then saw Eric and Kurt on the center court and dropped his bike into the grass.
Take a seat, Kurt. Let a man take over. You couldn't hit Eric's serve if your dog's life depended on it.
Kurt ceded his end of the court to Kent, a bon vivant who did not seem to feel any pressing need to visit the office and explain his late arrival. Eric served, and Jared was delighted when the newly arrived Kent smashed it right back at him.
The Aztecs believed that black moths were omens of bad luck, Mary said.
She had lost interest in the tennis match going on below.
There are people out in the hollers who still believe a white moth in the house means someone's going to die.
You are a regular mathematician, Mary.
Mary made a sad trombone noise.
Wait, you've never been in a holler in your life. You just made that up to be creepy. Good job, by the way.
No, I didn't make it up. I read it in a book.
She punched him in the shoulder. It kind of hurt, but Jared pretended it didn't. Those are brown ones, Jared said. What do brown ones mean?
Oh, that's interesting, Mary said. According to the Blackfeet Indians, brown moths bring sleep and dreams.
6. Jared sat on a bench at the far end of the locker room, dressing. The silly sophomores had already departed, afraid of getting whipped with wet towels, a thing for which Eric and his cohorts were famous. Or maybe the right word was infamous. You say frenulum, I say frenula, Jared thought, putting on his sneakers. Let's call the whole thing off. In the shower, Eric, Kurt, and Kent were hooting and splashing and bellowing all the standard witticisms.
Fuck you mother, I already did, fag, bite my bag, your sister's a skag, she's on the rag, etc.
It was tiresome, and there was so much high school left before he could escape. The water went off. Eric and the other two slapped wet-footed into the area of the locker room they considered their private preserve. Seniors only, please. Which meant Jared only had to suffer a brief glimpse at their bare butts before they disappeared around the corner. Fine with him. He sniffed his tennis socks, winced, stuffed them into his gym bag, and zipped it up.
I saw old Essie on my way here, Kent was saying. The homeless chick, the one with the shopping cart? Yeah, almost rode over and fell into that shithole where she lives. Someone ought to clean her out of there, Kurt said. She must have busted open her stash of two-buck chuck last night, Kent said, totally out cold. And she must have rolled in something. She had cobwebby crud all over her face. Fucking nasty. I could see it moving when she breathed. So I give her a yell, right? Hey, Essie, what's up, girl? What's up, you toothless old cunt? Nothing, man. Fucking flatline, Kurt said. I wish there was a magic potion to put girls to sleep so you could bang them without having to butter them up first. There is, Eric said. It's called roofies.
As they bellowed laughter, Jared thought, that's the guy taking Mary to see Arcade Fire. That guy right over there. Plus, Kent said, she's got all kinds of weird shit in that little ravine she sleeps in, including the top half of a department store mannequin. I'll fuck just by anything, man, but a drunk-ass homeless bitch covered in spider webs? That's where I draw the line, and that line is thick. My line is totally dotted right now, there was a wistful note in Kurt's voice. The situation is desperate.
I'd bone a zombie on The Walking Dead.
You already did, Eric said. Harriet Davenport.
More prehistoric laughter.
Why am I listening to this? Jared asked himself, and it occurred to him again. Mary is going to a concert with one of these sickos. She has no idea what Eric is actually like. And after our conversation on the bleachers, I'm not sure she'd believe me if I told her.
You would not bone this chick, Kent said. But it's funny. We ought to go by after school, check her out.
Never mind after school, Eric said. Let's cut out after sixth period.
Whacking sounds as they slapped hands, sealing the deal. Jared grabbed his gym bag and left. It wasn't until lunch that Frankie Johnson sat down next to Jared and said the weird female sleeping sickness that used to be only in Australia and Hawaii had shown up in D.C., Richmond, and even in Martinsburg, which wasn't that far away. Jared thought briefly of what Kent had said about old Essie, spiderwebs on her face, then decided it couldn't be. Not here. Nothing that interesting ever happened in dueling.
They're calling it Aurora, Frankie said. Hey, is that chicken salad? How is it? Want to trade?
Chapter 5 1 Unit 12 of A-Wing was bare except for the single bunk, the steel toilet, and the camera bulbs in the corners of the ceiling. No painted square on the wall for posting pictures, no desk. Coates had dragged in a plastic chair to sit on while Clint examined Kitty McDavid, who lay on the bunk.
So? Asked Coates.
She's alive. Her vitals are strong. Clint stood from his crouch. He unsnapped his surgical gloves and carefully placed them in a plastic bag. From his jacket pocket, he took out a small pad and a pen and began to jot notes.
I don't know what that stuff is. It's tacky, like sap, and it's also tough. And yet it's evidently permeable because she's breathing through it. It smells earthy, I guess, and a little waxy. If you pressed me, I'd say it was some kind of a fungus, but it's not behaving like any fungus I've ever seen or heard of.
To even attempt to discuss the situation made Clint feel as if he were climbing up a hill made of pennies. A biologist could take a sample and put it under a microscope.
I've been told that it's a bad idea to remove the stuff.
Clint clicked his pen, stuck it and the pad back in his coat. Well, I'm not a biologist anyway. And since she seems comfortable. The growth on Kitty's face was white and gauzy, tight to her skin. It made Clint think of a winding sheet. He could tell that her eyes were shut, and he could tell that they were moving in REM. The idea that she was dreaming under the stuff troubled him, although he wasn't sure why. Little wisps of the gauzy material unspooled from her limp hands and wrists, wafting out as if breeze-blown, catching onto the waist area of McDavid's uniform, forming connections. Based on the way the stuff was spreading, Clint extrapolated that it would eventually create a full-body covering.
It looks like a fairy handkerchief.
The warden had her arms crossed. She didn't appear upset, just thoughtful.
Fairy handkerchief?
Grass spiders make them. You see them in the morning while it's still dewy.
Oh, right. I see them in the backyard sometimes.
They were quiet for a moment, watching the little tendrils of gauzy material. Beneath the coating, Kitty's eyelids fluttered and shifted. What kind of trip was she on in there? Was she dreaming of scoring? Kitty told him once that she liked the prospect even better than the high, the sweet anticipation. Was she dreaming of cutting herself? Was she dreaming of Lowell Greiner, the drug dealer who promised to kill her if she ever talked about his operation? Or was her brain gone, blacked out by the virus, if it was a virus, of which the webbing was the foremost manifestation? Her rolling eyes, the neural equivalent of a torn power line shooting off sparks.
This is fucking scary, Janice said. And that's not a phrase I use lightly.
Clint was glad Lila was coming. Whatever was going on between them, he wanted to see her face.
I had to call my son, Clint said, mostly to himself.
Rand Quigley, the officer on the floor, poked his head in. He darted a quick, uneasy glance at the incapacitated woman with the shrouded face before shifting toward the warden and clearing his throat.
The sheriff's ETA is 20 or 30 minutes with her prisoner.
He hung there a moment.
Got the word about the double shifts from Blanche, Warden. I'm here as long as you need me.
Good man, she said.
On the walk over, Clint had briefly filled Coates in about the woman from the murder scene and that Lila was bringing her in. The warden, far more concerned about what Michaela had told her, had been uncharacteristically nonchalant about such a breach of protocol. Clint had been relieved by that, but only for a few seconds, because then she'd hit him with everything she knew about Aurora. Before Clint could ask if she was joking, she'd shown him her iPhone, which was sent to the front page of the New York Times. "Epidemic," howled the 20-point headline. The corresponding article said that women were forming coatings in their sleep, that they weren't waking up, that there were mass riots in the Western time zones and fires in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Nothing about bad shit happening if the gauze was removed, Clint noticed. Possibly because that was just a rumor. Possibly because it was true and the press was trying not to ignite full-scale panic. At this point, who could tell?
You can call your son in a few minutes, but Clint, this is a big goddamn deal. We've got 6 officers on the shift, plus you, me, Blanche in the office, and Dunphy for maintenance. And there are 114 female inmates with one more on the way. Most of the officers, they're like Quigley, they recognize they've got a duty, and I expect they'll hold tight for a bit. For which I thank God, because I don't know when we can expect reinforcements or what they'll amount to. You see?
Clint saw.
All right. To start with, Doc, what do we do about Kitty?
We contact the CDC, ask them to send some boys in hazmat suits to come in and take her out, get her examined, but... Clint opened his hands, an expression of how pointless that would be.
If this is as widespread as you've told me, and the news certainly seems to agree that it is, we're not going to get any help until there's help to get, right?
Coates still had her arms crossed. Clint wondered if she was holding herself to keep from showing the shakes. The idea made him feel simultaneously better and worse.
And I suppose we can't expect St. Teresa's or anyone else to take her off her hands right now, either. They probably have their hands full, too.
We should call around, but that's my expectation, Clint said. So let's lock her up tight, keep her quarantined. We don't want anyone else getting close to her or touching her, even with gloves on. Van can monitor her from the booth. If anything changes, if she appears distressed, if she wakes up, we'll come running.
Sounds like a plan.
She brushed at the air where a moth was flitting around.
Stupid bug. How'd these things get in here? God damn it. Next, Adam. What about the rest of the population? How do we treat them?
What do you mean? Clint flapped a hand at the moth, but missed. It circled up to the fluorescent bank in the ceiling.
If they fall asleep...
The warden gestured at McDavid. Clint touched his forehead, half expecting to find it burning with fever. A demented multiple-choice question came to him. How do you keep the inmates of a prison awake? Select from the following. A. Play Metallica over the prison's public address system on an infinite loop. B. Give every prisoner a knife and tell them to cut themselves when they start to feel sleepy. C. Give every prisoner a sack of Dexedrine. D. All of the above. E. You don't.
There is medication that can keep people awake, but Janice, I'd say a near majority of the women here are drug addicts. The idea of pumping them all up with what's basically speed doesn't strike me as safe or healthy. Anyhow, something like, say, Provigil, it's not like I could write a prescription for 100 tablets.
I think the pharmacist at Rite Aid would look askance, you know? Bottom line, I don't see any way to help them. All we can do is keep things as normal as possible and try to tamp down any panic. Hope for some kind of explanation or breakthrough in the meantime, and...
Clint hesitated for a moment before dispensing the euphemism that seemed like the only way to put it, and yet totally wrong.
And let nature take her course. Although this was no form of nature he was familiar with. She sighed. They went out into the hall, and the warden told Quigley to pass the word. No one was to touch the growth on McDavid.
2. The woodshop inmates ate in the carpentry shed instead of the mess hall, and on nice days they were allowed to have lunch outside in the shade of the building. This one was nice, a thing for which Jeanette Sorley was grateful. She had begun sprouting a headache in the garden while Dr. Norcross was on the phone, and now it was boring deeper, like a steel rod working its way inward from her left temple. The stink of the varnish wasn't helping. some fresh outside air might blow the pain away. At 11:50, two Red Tops, trustees, rolled in a table with sandwiches, lemonade, and chocolate pudding cups. At 12, the buzzer went. Jeanette gave a final twist to the chair leg she was finishing and then flicked off her lathe. Half a dozen inmates did the same. The decibel level dropped. Now the only sound in the room, hot in here already and not even June, was the steady, high-pitched whine of the power vac, which Ree Dempster was using to clean up the sawdust between the last row of machines and the wall.
"Turn that off, inmate!"
Tig Murphy bellowed. He was a newer hire. Like most new hires, he bellowed a lot because he was still unsure of himself.
"It's lunch! Did you not hear the buzzer?"
Ree started.
"Officer, I just got this one more little..."
"Off! I said off!"
"Yes, officer."
Ree turned off the power back, and the silence gave Jeanette a shiver of relief. Her hands ached inside her work gloves. Her head ached from the stink of the varnish. All she wanted was to go back to good old B7, where she had aspirin, an approved green med, but only a dozen allowed per month. Then maybe she could sleep until B-Wing Chow at 6.
"Line up, hands up," Officer Murphy chanted. "Line up, hands up, let me see those tools, ladies."
They lined up. Ree was in front of Jeanette and whispered,
"Officer Murphy is kind of fat, isn't he?"
"Probably been eating cake with Michelle Obama,"
Jeanette whispered back, and Ree giggled. They held up their tools, hand sanders, screwdrivers, drills, chisels. Jeanette wondered if male inmates would have been allowed access to such potentially dangerous weapons, especially the screwdrivers. You could kill with a screwdriver, as she well knew. And that's what the pain in her head felt like. A screwdriver, pushing in, finding the soft meat and disarranging it.
"Shall we eat al fresco today, ladies?"
Someone had mentioned that Officer Murphy had been a high school teacher until he lost his job when the faculty was downsized.
"That means..."
"Outside," Jeanette mumbled. "That means eating outside."
Murphy pointed at her.
"We have a Rhodes Scholar among us."
But he was smiling a little, so it didn't sound mean. The tools were checked off and collected and put into a steel floor chest that was then locked. The furniture crew shuffled to the table, grabbed sandwiches and Dixie cups of drink, and waited for Murphy to do the count.
"Ladies, the great outdoors awaits you. Someone grab me a ham and cheese."
"You got it, cutie,"
Angel Fitzroy murmured under her breath. Murphy gave her a sharp glance, which Angel returned with an innocent gaze. Jeanette felt a little sorry for him. "But sorry don't buy no groceries," as her mother used to say. She gave Murphy 3 months, at most. The women filed out of the shed, sat down on the grass, and leaned against the wall of the building.
"What'd you get?" Ree asked.
Jeanette peered into the depths of her sandwich. "Chicken."
"I got tuna. Want to trade?"
Jeanette didn't care what she had. She wasn't a bit hungry, so she swapped. She made herself eat, hoping it might make her head feel a little better. She drank the lemonade, which tasted bitter, but when Ree brought her a pudding cup, Jeanette shook her head. Chocolate was a migraine trigger, and if her current headache turned into one of those, she would have to go to the infirmary for a Zomig, which she would only get if Dr. N was still here. Word had gone around that the regular PAs hadn't come in. A cement path ran toward the main prison building, and someone had decorated it with a fading hopscotch grid. A few women got up, found stones, and started to play, chanting rhymes they must have learned as kids. Jeanette thought it was funny what stuck in a person's head. She pounded down the last bite of sandwich with the last swallow of bitter lemonade, leaned back, and closed her eyes. Was her head getting a little better? Maybe. In any case, they had another 15 minutes at least. She could nap a little. That was when Officer Peters popped out of the carpentry shed like a bouncy little jack-in-the-box. Or a troll who had been hiding under a rock. He looked at the women playing hopscotch, then at the women sitting against the side of the building. His eyes settled on Jeanette.
"Sorley, get in here. I got a job for you."
Fucking Peters. He was a tit-squeezer and an ass-patter, always managing to do it in one of the multiple blind spots the cameras couldn't quite reach. He knew them all. And if you said anything, you were apt to get your tit wrung instead of just squeezed.
I'm on my lunch break, officer, she said as pleasantly as she could. Looks like you're finished to me. Now get off your duff and come along.
Murphy looked uncertain, but one rule about working in a women's prison had been drummed into his head. Male officers were not allowed to be one-on-one with any inmate.
Buddy system, Don.
Color suffused Peters's cheeks. He was in no mood for ticky-tack from Teach, not after the 1-2 combination of Coates's harassment and the call he'd just received from Blanche McIntyre that he had to pull a double because of the national situation. Don had checked his phone. The national situation was that a bunch of old ladies in a nursing home had a fungus. Coates was out of her mind.
I don't want any of her buddies, Don said. I just want her.
He's gonna let it go, Jeanette thought. In this place, he's just a baby. But Murphy surprised her.
Buddy system, he repeated.
Perhaps Officer Murphy would be able to hack it after all. Peters considered. The women sitting against the shed were looking at him, and the hopscotch game had stopped. They were inmates, but they were also witnesses.
Yoo-hoo!
Angel gave a queenly wave.
Oh, yoo-hoo! You know me, Officer Peters. I'm always happy to help.
It occurred to Don, alarmingly, absurdly, that Fitzroy somehow knew what he had in mind. Of course she didn't. She was just trying to be irritating, like every other minute of the day. While he would have liked 5 minutes alone with that lunatic sometime, he did not care at all for the idea of having his back turned to her for so much as 1 second. No, not Fitzroy. Not for this. He pointed at Rhee.
You, dumpster.
Some of the women giggled.
Dempster,
Rhee said, and with actual dignity.
Dempster, dumpster, dimple butt, I don't give a fuck. Both of you, come on. Don't make me ask again, not with the day I'm having.
He glanced at Murphy, the smartass.
See you later, teacher gator.
This provoked more giggles, these of the ass-licking variety. Murphy was new and out of his depth, and none of them wanted to be on Officer Peters' shit list. They weren't totally stupid, Don thought, the women in this place. 3. Officer Peters marched Jeanette and Rhee a quarter of the way down Broadway and halted them outside the common room / visitor's room, which was deserted with everyone at lunch. Jeanette was starting to get a very bad feeling about this. When Peters opened the door, she didn't move.
What do you want us to do? Are you blind, inmate?
No, she wasn't blind. She saw the mop bucket with the mop leaning against it, and on one of the tables, another plastic bucket. This one was full of rags and cleaning products instead of pudding cups.
This is supposed to be our lunchtime.
Rhee was trying for indignant, but the tremor in her voice spoiled it.
Besides, we've already got work.
Peters bent toward her, lips pulled back to show the pegs of his teeth, and Rhee shrank back against Jeanette.
You can put it on your TS list and give it to the chaplain later, okay? Right now, just get in there, and if you don't want to go on bad report, don't argue the point. I'm having a shitty day, I'm in an extremely shitty mood, and unless you want me to share the wealth, you better step to it.
Then, moving to his right to block the sightline of the nearest camera, he grabbed Rhee by the back of her smock, hooking his fingers into the elastic strap of her sports bra. He shoved her into the common room. Rhee stumbled and grabbed the side of the snack machine to keep from falling.
Okay, okay.
Okay, what?
Okay, Officer Peters.
You shouldn't push us, Jeanette said. That's not right.
Don Peters rolled his eyes.
Save your lip for someone who cares. Visitation day tomorrow and this place looks like a pigsty.
Not to Jeanette, it didn't. To her, it looked fine. Not that it mattered. If the man in the uniform said it looked like a pigsty, it looked like a pigsty. That was the nature of corrections as it existed in Little Dueling County, and probably all over the world.
You two are going to clean it from top to bottom and stem to stern, and I'm going to make sure you do the job right.
He pointed to the bucket of cleaning supplies.
That's yours, dumpster. Miss That's Not Right gets to mop, and I want that floor so clean I could eat my dinner off it.
I'd like to feed you your dinner off it, Jeanette thought. But she went to the rolling mop bucket. She did not want to go on bad report. If that happened, she would very likely not be in this room when her sister arrived with her son to visit her this coming weekend. That was a long bus ride, and how she loved Bobby for never complaining about making it. But her headache was getting worse, and all she wanted in this world was her aspirin and a nap. Ree inspected the cleaning supplies and selected a spray can and a rag.
You want to sniff that pledge, dumpster? Shoot some up your snoot and get high?
No, Ree said.
You'd like to get high, wouldn't you?
No.
No what?
No, Officer Peters. Ree began to polish a table. Jeanette filled the mop bucket from the sink in the corner, wet the mop, squeegeed it, and began to do the floor. Through the chain-link fence in front of the prison, she could see West Lavin, where cars filled with free people traveled back and forth, to work, to home, to lunch at Denny's, to someplace.
Get over here, Sorley, Peters said.
He was standing between the snack machine and the soda machine, a camera blind spot where inmates sometimes exchanged pills and cigarettes and kisses. She shook her head and kept mopping. Long, wet streaks on the linoleum that dried quickly.
Get over here if you want to see your boy next time he's here.
I ought to say no, she thought. I ought to say, you leave me alone or I'll report you. Only he's been getting away with it a long time, hasn't he? Everyone knew about Peters. Coates had to know, too, but in spite of all her big talk about having zero tolerance for sexual harassment, it kept going on. Jeanette trudged to the little alcove between the machines and stood before him, head down, mop in one hand.
In there, back against the wall. Never mind the mop, you can leave that.
I don't want to, officer. Her headache was really bad now, throbbing and throbbing. B7 was just down the corridor with her aspirin on her little shelf.
You get in here, or you go on bad report and lose your visitation. Then I'll make sure you get another bad report, and poof, there goes your good time.
And my chance of parole next year, Jeanette thought. No good time, no parole, back to square one, case closed. She squeezed past Peters, and he rocked his hips into her so she could feel his boner. She stood against the wall. Peters moved in. She could smell his sweat and aftershave and hair tonic. She was taller than he was, and over his shoulder she could see her celly. Ree had stopped polishing. Her eyes were filled with fear, dismay, and what might have been anger. She was gripping the can of pledge and slowly raising it. Jeanette gave her head a minute shake. Peters didn't see. He was busy unzipping his fly. Ree lowered the can and resumed polishing the table that needed no more polishing, hadn't needed any in the first place.
Now cop my joint, Peters said. I need some relief. You know what I wish? I wish you was Coatsy. I wish I had her old flat ass backed up against this wall.
If it was her, it wouldn't be just a pull-off, either.
He gasped as she grasped him.
It was sort of ridiculous, really. He had no more than 3 inches. Nothing he'd want other men to see unless it was absolutely unavoidable. But it was hard enough. And she knew what to do. Most women did. Guys had a gun. You unloaded it. They went about their business.
Easy, Jesus, he hissed.
His breath was rotten with some spicy meat, maybe a Slim Jim or a pepperoni stick.
Wait, give me your hand.
She gave it to him and he spat in her palm.
Now do it, and tickle my balls a little.
She did as she was told, and while she did it, she kept her eyes on the window beyond his shoulder. This was a technique she had begun learning at 11, when her stepfather touched her, and had perfected with her late husband. If you found something to lock onto, a point of focus, you could almost leave your body behind and pretend it was doing its own thing while you were visiting whatever it was you suddenly found so fascinating. A county sheriff's car stopped outside, and Jeanette watched it first wait in the dead space and then roll into the yard once the inner gate rumbled open. Warden Coates, Dr. Norcross, and Officer Lampley walked out to meet it. Officer Peters's breath panting in her ear was far away. 2 cops got out of the car, a woman from behind the wheel and a man from the passenger side. They both drew their sidearms, which suggested that their prisoner was a bad sugar pop, probably bound for Sea Wing. The woman officer opened the back door, and another woman got out. She didn't look dangerous to Jeanette. She looked beautiful, in spite of the bruises on her face. Her hair was a dark flood down her back, and she had enough curves to even make the baggy county browns she was wearing look cool. Something was fluttering around her head. A big mosquito? A moth? Jeanette tried to see, but she couldn't be sure. Peters's gasps had taken on a squeaky edge. The male officer took the dark-haired woman by the shoulder and got her walking toward intake, where Norcross and Coates met her. Once inside, the process would begin. The woman brushed at the flyer, circling her hair, and as she did so, her wide mouth opened and she tilted her head to the sky, and Jeanette saw her laugh, saw her bright, straight teeth. Peters began to buck against her, and his ejaculate pumped into her hand. He stepped back. His cheeks were flushed. There was a smile on his fat little face as he zipped up his fly. "Wipe that on the back of the Coke machine, Sorley, and then finish mopping the fucking floor." Jeanette wiped his semen away, then pushed the mop bucket back down to the sink so she could rinse off her hand. When she came back, Peters was sitting at one of the tables and drinking a Coke.
"You okay?"
Ree whispered.
"Yes,"
Jeanette whispered back. And she would be, as soon as she got some aspirin for her head. The last 4 minutes hadn't even happened. She had been watching the woman get out of the police cruiser. That was all. She didn't need to think about the last 4 minutes ever again. She just needed to see Bobby on his next visit.
St-